This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. I am so excited to be here with you today. We have big news on the Solve It for Kids podcast. I'm getting a new co-host. Jedley has been amazing, and I am so thankful for all the help he has given me, but he has decided to focus his time on his hugely popular Reading With Your Kids podcast. So be sure to go over and check that out, Reading With Your Kids podcast, not to be missed. But my new co-host on the Solve It for Kids podcast is author and space educator Jeff Gagne. You're going to love him. We are going to have so much fun doing the same thing on the Solve It for Kids podcast we've done so far. You will meet Jeff in 2 weeks. So we are working on scheduling and taping our new guests. Some of the episodes you have to look forward to are: how do you photograph a picture on Mars? How do you get oil from a rock? And how does your brain think? These are just a few of the episodes that we are working on. So this week, I'm going to leave you with one of our favorite episodes from the vault. It is The Best of Space.
How will we communicate with people on Mars?
We are so excited to have Dr. Darlene Lim talk to us today, and she is working on the problem of how are we going to talk to these astronauts? We send them to Mars. Don't you think we need to communicate with them and talk to them?
Absolutely. So, hey, Dr. Darlene, welcome to the show.
Dr. Darlene, welcome to Solve It. Thank you for being here.
Hey.
My pleasure. We are so excited to learn. I mean, all people talk about these days is, of course, you know, everybody's trying to get to the moon in 2024, but everybody's looking down the road at Mars. And so tell us a little bit about your project and what you're working on.
Okay. Yeah, my pleasure. So we've been looking at the problem of sending humans to Mars, or not really the problem, but all the complexities involved with sending humans to Mars. But we've been trying to look at it in a very specific way. So I'm a scientist, and I'm interested in enabling or helping people do science on the surface of Mars, science that's meaningful to humanity, meaningful to all the scientists that will have to stay here on Earth. But the real kind of crux of our interest is, how do you actually have a conversation between the astronauts that are on the surface of Mars who may have a question for the subject matter experts, for the person that is the most well-versed in the field of microbiology on basalt, who has to stay on Earth? How do they talk back and forth when, in fact, when somebody is on Mars and a bunch of people are on Earth, there's going to be a communication delay? So because of the way that the planets orbit around the sun and orbit around each other, or, you know, they're in different orientations between each other, there's going to be a delay ranging from anywhere around 4 minutes to just over 20 minutes one way. So you imagine, like, if you, right. So if you said wow to me on Mars, I wouldn't hear it till like 3 minutes later on Earth. And then if I want to react, I'm thinking, what did she just say wow to? Was it the thing that happened 3 minutes ago? Or like, yeah, okay, really confusing. So it's basically, I'm trying to help somebody select the best rock that's going to test a whole bunch of hypotheses and open up our understanding of life in our solar system and beyond. How do I do that? How do I do that when there is a delay, when I can only really see a small view of what they're seeing, when I have no sense of the environment that they're dealing with, how dangerous it might be for them to step to the left, to the right? And how do I help them make a decision about which sample, for example, to pick up when we only have about, you know, let's say 4 to 6 hours of safe time for these astronauts to walk around on the surface of Mars? So you can't just expect them to keep walking and then have limitless amount of time for the people on Earth to make a decision. There are lots of what are called constraints or limitations to the time over which anybody can make a decision, whether on Mars or on Earth, or ask for help or so forth. So lots of little devil in the detail things we try and work out.
Well, and you would think that, because if you ask a question, kind of like, hey, should I move over to that rock? Then you just stand there and wait for 20 minutes or 40 minutes for the answer to come back, right?
Right.
You're kind of wasting time. Or hopefully, I guess, it depending on if you're on the same side, maybe it's only 8 minutes, but still, you're just kind of standing there on Mars tapping your foot. Okay, wait for
time. Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's incredibly interesting working with the people that support human exploration directly. So folks that are in what's called the EVA branch, the extravehicular activity branch of NASA, who think about this every single day, because they have expressed to me the fact that idle time, anytime somebody is standing around, is a very dangerous period of an EVA, because lots of things could go wrong. You don't want to put anyone in a situation where they're outside in these dangerous elements and not doing something of value, because it's just wasted time for a number of reasons, and it's very dangerous. So we want to make sure, so I'm really glad you brought that up, because fundamentally we want to make sure that when the astronauts are out doing an EVA, conducting a spacewalk on the surface of Mars, say in service of science, every single moment of their time is valuable, even if that moment is allowing them to think. It's got to be valuable. So they can't just sit around. It's not a good idea. Just like having a kid sit around and do nothing. It's sometimes really not a good idea either. So it's that balance of allowing people to think, but be busy at the same time,
right,
and also enable conversation back and forth, despite all these crazy operational limitations and the limitations of light speed and so forth.
I'm wondering, can you figure out, based on where Mars is in conjunction with the sun and the Earth, how long it's going to take? Or you don't know, one message might take 4 minutes to get here, and then your reply might take 20 minutes, or is it something you can predict?
It's predictable. So that part is predictable. What is not necessarily predictable is what happens when you have people operating on Mars or even on Earth as an example. What I mean by this is, if all things being equal, I know that if I place a cell phone call to you right now, it'll get through. There'll be no issue, right? But what if you walk behind a tall building or a set of tall buildings and suddenly your cell connection is knocked out? I can't know that necessarily. We could do our best when we plan these human missions to make sure that there are no loss of communication moments, because that's a really scary thing to happen during an EVA, is what's called loss of comms.
If you want to know what happens in case of a loss of comms, be sure to listen to the entire interview with Dr. Darlene Lim on solveitforkids.com. Right now, time to blast off with Katie Coleman.
How do you live in space?
We are going to talk to the amazing Katie Coleman, who is an astronaut and who actually lived in space on the International Space Station. And she's going to share her experiences all with us. And she has a special challenge for you.
Awesome. Welcome, Katie.
I love just the introductions where I'm like, oh, I want to spend time with these people and find out what they are thinking about. I can't wait to hear the questions.
Well, we are excited to have you, as I said. For those of you that don't know but might have read my Astronaut Aquanaut book, Katie is one of the experts that was featured in my book. And if you've had me to your school to talk about it, you get to see the picture that I show of Katie floating through the air as she's at the International Space Station. So we're going to talk to her about today, because the problem that Katie is going to help us solve, or tell us how she solved, is how do you live in space? So Katie, can you tell us maybe a little bit about how many times you've been in space and how long you've lived in space? Start with that.
So I'm an astronaut, and I went twice to space on the space shuttle. First time was for 16 days, the longest mission we'd ever had at the time. And it was literally like practice for the space station, because it was a science mission. We had in the back of the space shuttle, we had a laboratory, and we had about 30 different science experiments. And by being a scientist, I was able to understand, you know, what are these experiments about? What are their goals? And how can we help them solve their problems? And our problem that we were addressing on that mission was, we are building a space station, and we have to like figure out, when everybody's doing experiments and everybody wants to call down to the ground and talk to the different scientists down there, how are we going to organize that? Can everybody talk at once? And Can we take pictures? Can we send all those questions about we're going to have a space station and we better be ready. So that was my first mission. My second one was to launch the Chandra X-ray Observatory, which is like the sister of telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope and the Gamma Ray Observatory. And basically, I think somebody said, okay, we've got a whole spectrum of wavelengths that tell stories, and we have telescopes that look at this, telescopes that look at this. Well, what about a telescope that looks at X-rays? Because it turns out black holes and X-rays, they're like this. So when things are being sucked into a black hole, X-rays are being spewed out. And so by saying, let's have a telescope that can measure X-rays, and they had a pretty cool problem-solving challenge for that. Maybe we could go back to it.
Oh, yeah. That's fabulous.
We had that. And then I spent 6 months on the International Space Station, almost just a few days shy of that. And I loved living up there, but we did have to solve some interesting problems. And actually, my problem there was, you know, when we take a picture in on the ground here, you stand 2 feet, you hold the camera steady, you try not to do this, right? Because you want the camera to be really steady. Well, if you're floating everywhere, how do you take a good picture? And especially in the shuttle where I'm not going to stay on the ground and I'm not tall enough to actually even hit the ceiling and be steady. So what I figured out was I had to hold on to the back of a seat, and someone else also held on to me, not just my spacesuit, because there I'm moving in my spacesuit, but they had to like grab my leg so that I could take those pictures. But when you see those pictures of Chandra, the Chandra telescope is long and skinny. It has a pointy end and a bigger end. And the bigger end is actually where everything goes in.
Oh my gosh. So, I mean, yeah, you don't even think about that when you want to take a picture. You just stand still, but think about everything you had to do to be still. And then I assume you hold your hands really still, but still you're moving.
But then if you're moving.
Right. You're moving.
Literally, you need some help. And sometimes the best camera stand is one of your friends up on orbit to hold on to.
So how do you brush your teeth in space? Because clearly here we brush. We spit into the sink, the water, everything goes down into the sink and gets washed away. How do you do that in space?
Well, you have some options, but you have brought up basically the only thing that when I got back to Earth, I was sort of glad to come back to Earth and do it what I thought of as a regular way. And that is, I mean, you want to spit, and let's think about this. I mean, whatever came out of your mouth is going to go as far as it can go until it hits something, which really just might be your friend's brand new shirt. We only have it, right? It's bad. And so spitting is not practical. Okay.
Okay.
It's not. And so what you can do is you can either spit into a paper towel and then throw that away.
Okay.
And I'll say that we think about every single, like, paper towels. I would never dream of using a whole wet wipe or a whole paper towel. I mean, we cut them in pieces. I mean, because you never know when the supply ship's going to be there. So that's the other part of our sort of calculation when we figure out a new way to do things is what's the best way to conserve our resources. But, you know, spitting into a paper towel, that's okay. That works. It's kind of yucky.
Yeah.
But then you can also, what I did is I would just swallow it. I mean, you know, you put that toothpaste on your toothbrush. I mean, it's the same food you already had in your mouth. I know the math all adds up there. It's still kind of gross, right? I was really glad to come home and not do that anymore.
You all miss Jed's gross. He made this face like, ew. But, you know, I suppose when you're in space, you have to get used to doing different things. And, I mean, it's like you said, you have to make do with what you have up there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you can call up and say, hey, we're out of toilet paper. Can you just send some more?
Exactly.
I suppose some of those lessons you learned about conserving toilet paper and paper towels would really come in handy these days.
Well, you know, it's really true that this is the time during COVID-19 where it's a little uncertain. I mean, things will seem kind of normal, but the infection rate could increase. And I'm thankful for all the people that are working. And they're working, mm-hmm. delivering and being in warehouses and keeping the rest of us supplied. But we try to, you know, make sure that we're not going to have to make them work any harder than is really necessary by conserving.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly.
That's true.
So what are some of the other problems that you had to solve when you were in space just living there? I mean, did you sleep okay? Because we all like to climb into our beds and lay down and you snuggle, but you guys float while you sleep, right?
So from a problem-solving perspective, I mean, first of all, people are all going to solve problems in different ways, right?
Yeah.
And we all kind of sleep in different ways. I mean, I don't know. I only know about sort of our family, right? But I imagine everybody sleeps different. I like to sleep all curled up. And what we have for sleeping is we have a sleeping bag. It's not all padded and thick because it's not really like cold up there, but it is almost like the thickness of a bedspread, or it's like a little eyeglass case that we kind of like slither into. But it has armholes so we can have our arms out so that I can still reach something, or I can answer the intercom if something is happening on the space station or things like that, or at least I can hear. And so your sleeping bag can be tethered to the wall just with like little bungee cords or little knots. We have hooks on the wall, and then you go slide in, you go to sleep. But problem solve, what are some of the things that you miss? Some people just miss feeling like they have that nice pillow under their head. So a way to solve that is they sent us with some pillows that have straps on them. And you can strap your pillow to your head.
Oh, my gosh.
Side of your head, like with a headband. And now you're going to feel like you have a pillow. So that was one solution for some people. I do like to sleep, like, curled up in a ball. I loved actually being in space. And so I didn't necessarily hook my sleeping bag on the wall all the time. Sometimes I just would, like, oh, I just kind of feel like floating around. We have, like, a cabin. It's a size, I'd say, of an old-fashioned phone booth, right? And so what I would do is tuck up my knees, right?
Yeah.
And then I would zip up that sleeping bag. So now I'm in a little ball held by the zipper, right?
Right.
I'm not
right.
relying on gravity to let me curl up and stay there. And then I would go to sleep. And I would wake up in the morning. In this cabin, I have like a little stand that my computer is on. And sometimes I wake up in the morning and I'd be looking at the box, like, oh, I guess I must be underneath the computer desk.
You know? Oh, you're just floating around. Oh my God. What does that feel like? I mean, I guess you're floating around the whole time, so maybe it doesn't feel different, but can you imagine that, Jen?
I think that would be the weirdest thing and the most amazing thing in the world. Or out of this world, or I'm not sure how you say it. And I'm not sure, Katie, I'm not even sure how you'd have a drink in space.
If you want to drink something.
If you want to find out how an astronaut takes a drink in space, you've got to check out solveitforkids.com and listen to the entire interview with astronaut Katie Coleman. Right now, we're going to talk to Dr. Suzanne Slade.
How do you test a rocket without blowing it up?
We are honored to have on our show today engineer Suzanne Slade, who's going to talk to us about how you do these tests. But Suzanne is also a children's author. Isn't that cool?
That is amazing. I just can't wait. Can I say hi to Suzanne? Welcome her?
Absolutely.
Hey, Suzanne, welcome to Solve It for Kids.
Well, hi, Jen and Jed. I'm so excited to be here on Solve It. I have loved listening to your shows. You guys are awesome, and I can't wait to talk with you today. Tell us a little bit about how you came to test the rocket. What did you do in your career?
Okay, well, Jennifer, this is a time when I worked at a company called McDonnell Douglas Space Systems in Huntington Beach, California, and my job there was the test engineer. And so what would happen is McDonnell Douglas was creating, I worked on Delta and Titan rockets, which NASA would purchase to launch satellites that would help us get newscasts from around the world, would help us with our GPS that we use in our car and our phones. So as my job as a test engineer, what I needed to do was to make sure that the rocket was going to be safe when it launches, that it would launch and not blow up, okay? So what you need to do then as an engineer is you need to test the parts separately and then assemble some of them and test them again. So there's a lot of testing that goes on all along the way.
Now, Suzanne, one of the things, we spoke to an engineer that was designing flying cars. And one of the things he said, and his job was, he was a tester, and he was saying his job was to break things. And so they took and they intentionally crashed a bunch of different flying cars to see what broke and what stayed together. I'm guessing you can't intentionally crash a rocket.
This is true, right. And I also worked in automotive. Another job I had at another time was working on car brakes. And yes, as an engineer, sometimes you need to test something to its limit until it breaks So then you know better how it will work in the vehicle you want it to be in. But you're right. In the case of a rocket, where rocket parts, even just the separate parts, are so expensive, you don't want to intentionally break them, but you do want to test them so you know they're safe. So to your question about not blowing up a rocket, one of the big problems we had to solve was when we tested what was called a liquid oxygen tank, or for short, a LOX tank. And this was the tank in a Delta rocket. It was used when the rocket first launched, and there was fuel in it, but it needed a lot of oxygen, you know, how fuel needs oxygen to burn. So this liquid oxygen, if you compress it really tightly, you know, now it's in the air, it becomes a liquid. So this big, huge metal LOX tank, or liquid oxygen tank, we needed to test it to make sure it wouldn't explode when it was on the rocket launching. So to do that, we would pressurize the liquid oxygen tank, which means you pump a lot of air in it, kind of like when you blow up a balloon, but right. We pumped more and more air. We would pressurize it to a certain pressure, and then we felt if it could withstand that, a higher pressure than it would be exposed to when it was in the rocket during the launch. So we pressurized it. And so what could happen, though, when you've got a huge metal object under great pressure, if it did fail, if it did break apart, it would essentially become a bomb. It would explode, and it would injure any of us test engineers or technicians who were testing it. So this was the problem. How do we test it safely, knowing that if it did fail, we all wanted to stay safe? So finally, you know, often engineers, scientists work together as a team. You collaborate, you talk about ideas.
Right, right.
So we collaborated and we decided what we needed to do was test it in a bomb shelter.
Oh.
And that is a structure with very strong walls that is made safe. So if a bomb did go off, it would stay contained in the bomb shelter.
Right.
So we had a bomb shelter built underground, and then we could go down, take this liquid oxygen tank and other large parts, pressurize it. And here is what I think is the interesting part. So what if there was a small leak in it? I mean, that's what we would want to find. How would we see a small leak if we're just pumping air in it? How do you think we would see it?
Colorize it.
That's a thought, but you'd need a very dense color to even see a small amount. So what we did was we used bubble soap, like what you
I know you can't wait to find out how engineers use bubble soap to keep rockets from blowing up. And you can find out by going to our website, solveitforkids.com. Hey, we hope you've enjoyed this special best of episode of Solve It for Kids. You can listen to all of our episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on our website, solveitforkids.com.